this is indeed a very rapid course, but they are aware of other situations that are very similar to this around the country.
The health department confirms the first child death in Alaska from swine flu. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 7th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a unique recycling program in Fairbanks.
We're looking at it as a green-collar job for the homeless because I realize that a lot of people that come to the rescue mission, they don't have a problem finding a job. They have a problem keeping a job.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
A Fairbanks elementary student died of the H1N1 flu over the weekend. His is the second death attributed to the swine flu in Alaska. The 10-year-old attended school Thursday morning, but was released to his parents during the day. He was hospitalized in Fairbanks just after midnight and later evacuated to Anchorage's Providence Hospital, where he died Friday night. State epidemiologist Dr. Beth Funk told reporters yesterday that the child was previously healthy before showing the symptoms. She said what followed in the next day and a half was a very rapid and unusual deterioration.
We are not aware of any other situation in Alaska that has, you know, been like this severe and this rapid. However, we've been in touch with Centers for Disease Control and Influenza Branch, and they have informed us that this is indeed a very rapid course, but they are aware of other situations that are very similar to this around the country.
She says a second elementary school-aged child, also from Fairbanks, was sent to Providence Friday with flu symptoms, but is now doing well. There was no known connection between the two. Additionally, an 11-month-old infant had the H1N1 flu in July and was readmitted to the hospital sometime later, where he died. Funk says there is not a direct connection between the death and the flu, but tests are continuing. A report by the Division of Public Health last week shows the state has confirmed 460 cases of the flu in Alaska, with 18 people being hospitalized, which Dr. Funk says is very small. The outbreak is also widespread, meaning it is being found in all areas of the state. She says a comparison with the annual seasonal influenza is that this strain is starting much earlier in the year.
To have this circulating in Alaska, all regions, through the summer, it's unique. However, the severity of illness is probably on par with regular seasonal flu.
The department expects about 35,000 doses of vaccine to protect against the H1N1 flu to arrive in the first half of October. Priorities for that will be given for those 24 and younger and to pregnant women. A Fort Richardson soldier has died in Afghanistan. The Pentagon says Lieutenant Darren Andrews died Friday when his vehicle came under attack by rocket-propelled grenade fire and an improvised bomb. The attack happened in the Paktika province along the Afghan-Pakistani border south of the Afghan capital of Kabul. The 34-year-old Army officer was from Dallas. Veterans living in rural Alaska will now have easier access to health care, KDLG's Adam Kane reports.
A pilot program recently implemented by the Alaska Department of Veterans Affairs is intended to provide VA health care to veterans in their home communities. At this stage of the project, the VA healthcare system has designated 6 communities to participate in the program. The pilot communities include the Dillingham, Bristol Bay Borough, Bethel, Wade Hampton, and Northwest Arctic Borough census areas, as well as the city of Cordova. Marsha Hoffman DeVoe is the public affairs officer for the Alaska VA healthcare system. She says this project will include all currently enrolled veterans living in the designated pilot communities.
Well, the Rural Health Pilot Project is a pilot that's designed to help veterans receive medical care closer to their home rural community with the VA authorizing the care. So essentially, it's a way for the VA to help veterans get care that they deserve under their VA benefits. And as long as it's pre-authorized, we can pay for that care to a medical provider in the veteran's home community.
Hoffman DeVoe says that the new system not only eases health care access for veterans who had received related injuries while serving, it also provides health care to veterans who had no military service-related injuries at all.
Previously, veterans who didn't have a disability related to their service of at least 50% had to travel to Anchorage for that care to receive it at the VA clinic here in Anchorage. So now those veterans will be able to get their care paid for by VA in the community near where they live.
The primary care portion of the project has nearly $700,000 available to provide care for the approximately 550 veterans in the pilot communities. Hoffman DeVoe says that additional money was also requested to provide mental health services. 2 weeks ago, the VA sent out letters to the veterans asking them to opt into the project by returning a portion of the letter. Hoffman DeVoe says that in order to be eligible for the project, a veteran would need to opt in by the end of the month.
We are asking the veterans who received those letters to return them by September 30th. And that's just to give us an idea of how many veterans have received the letters and are interested in participating in the program, and that will help us to track the costs of the program.
The project has already begun and will continue to provide funding for healthcare in rural communities until the end of July 2010. Hoffman DeVoe says that at that time, the VA will assess the program for its adaptability to the rest of rural Alaska.
At the end of the pilot, we will be doing, some evaluation, and in fact, we'll actually be doing some focus groups, with veterans and with the healthcare providers in the community. So that listen, or watch, for announcements regarding that, because we will want to get the veterans' feedback for those who did participate, or even for those who choose not to participate, if we can hear why they choose not to participate. We want to hear both sides so that we can determine, are there things that we can do better or make changes that will make it attractive to more veterans.
All veterans in the designated communities are eligible for the new rural pilot project, including those who have recently returned from Afghanistan or Iraq. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Juneau Raptor Center releases two eagles back into the wild.
One, two, three. Come on, Bully. Oh, you're just standing there.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. THREAD helps families make good choices about early care and education for their children. Formerly known as Child Care Connection, THREAD connects families throughout Alaska with quality child care, family child care programs, licensed centers, preschool or Head Start programs at no cost. THREAD offers parenting workshops, resources, and help with parenting issues. Find out more online at threadalaska.org. This message sponsored by THREAD, connecting early care and education to Alaska.
Fishermen and others participated in aerial artwork Saturday, spelling out the words SOS Acid Ocean with nets and vessels in Ketchumak Bay. The oceans grow more acidic as more carbon dioxide is emitted into the atmosphere, and the Alaska Marine Conservation Council, National Fisheries Conservation Center, and other organizations put together the giant artwork to send a message to this winter's United Nations climate treaty talks about the acid problem, which may already be affecting northern fisheries. Lawmakers are reviewing a request to hire the husband of a legislative aide to write a report on the thorny issue of management of Cook Inlet salmon. Anchorage Representative Craig Johnson wants to give Mark Higgins the $20,000 contract. But at a salmon task force meeting last week, other lawmakers questioned whether it would be ethical. From member station KDLL, Ben Stanton reports.
The task force, consisting of 10 legislators, was initially formed in the spring of 2008. Their mission was to examine the poor salmon returns to Cook Inlet waterways and to attempt to ease some of the tensions between commercial and sport fishing interests. Chairman of the Salmon Task Force, Representative Craig Johnson of Anchorage, tells the Legislative Council that he wants the task force to hire Mark Higgins to review the testimony given to them. Johnson says there's about 1,000 pages of input from various sources. He wants Higgins to compile a condensed report.
hire someone who has a great amount of skill, editor of his law review in college, a technical writer that can disseminate this information into what I hope to be less than 100 pages of information that we could move forward with as policymakers to address some of the situations that exist in Cook Inlet.
Johnson also noted that Higgins is the husband of a staff member of his office, but he says the ethics board reviewed the situation and declared there is no conflict.
As long as there is no direct supervision, she is a staff member. She has no supervisory capacity in my office. We are outside of violating any ethics as a result of that. We have spouses working in the building together, and this is a contract position.
Representative Bert Stedman of Sitka says he's concerned that there's a perceived conflict in hiring Higgins. At the end of the meeting, the Legislative Council Chairman John Harris of Valdez made an executive decision to have Senate President Gary Stevens of Kodiak and Speaker of the House Mike Chenault of Nikiski work with Johnson to decide who should put together the report and how it should be done. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
Big cities make for poor habitat for salmon. Not much fish food grows on a bare concrete bulkhead. Scientists hope to change that. They're looking at new ways for salmon to live in the city, or at least find some food. The experiments come at a time when communities throughout the Northwest are rethinking the ecology of urban shorelines. Northwest News Network reporter Joshua McNichols went down to the water's edge in Seattle and Portland to see the scientists in action.
Downtown Seattle butts right up against the waters of Puget Sound. There used to be a beach here. Now that beach lies buried beneath roads, sewers, buildings, and train tracks. A massive concrete seawall prevents this tangle of infrastructure from sliding into Puget Sound. Just below the seawall, a pair of University of Washington scientists swims quietly through the water. They invite me to join them. So did you see any fish down there?
Yeah, there's a school of about 20 Chinook, actually right out there, right in front of me.
These are juvenile salmon, no bigger than your hand. They probably came from the polluted Duwamish River after hatching upstream. They're not ready for deeper water yet, so like a human teenager, they hang out downtown. Scientist Jason Toft and his crew collect the salmon in nets and drop them in a bucket of seawater. They want to see what the fish are eating.
Sloppy. Not bad on the first pull.
Because Chinook salmon are endangered, these fish get the royal treatment. Instead of slicing open the fish, Toft flushes out their stomachs with a plastic syringe.
All right, I got another wild Chinook coming up.
He catches their breakfast on a small metal screen.
Well, I can see he's been eating a lot of amphipods. So those are those small shrimp-like crustaceans. And almost his whole stomach is full of these amphipods. It looks like about 100 small amphipods.
Those amphipods, I can't even tell they're living creatures. They look like seeds or something.
Yeah, they're pretty small. I mean, it's pretty amazing. There's all sorts of small life out here that small fish feed on and need to feed on to grow up into big fish.
There's not much for fish to eat in downtown Seattle. They find a lot of their food in the thin layer of slime that grows on the concrete seawall. These scientists figure if they can roughen the seawall surface, add some complexity, they can dramatically increase the fish food that grows here. So the city let the team bolt heavily textured concrete panels to the existing seawall. Scientist Maureen Goff has been monitoring these panels for more than a year. In that time, she's seen them develop a complex ecosystem of their own.
That's part of the advantage of having the shade and the crevices, things that can retain water and detritus. All of these things help these organisms survive the low tides.
Washington's Department of Ecology likes the concrete panels a lot. Spokesperson Peter Scowen says this research could set a new standard for how existing seawalls are repaired or rebuilt throughout the state.
That's the restoration kind of thing that we'd like to see promoted. The study, I think, is not completed yet. It's too early to get any real findings out of it, but it is definitely one that we are following.
Much of the region's salmon recovery happens in rural areas, far away from the city. But you can't neglect habitat in urban centers. That's according to Jim Likatowicz. He's an Oregon biologist and writer. He says salmon must pass through a chain of habitats to complete their life cycle.
If you have three of those habitats that are degraded, and if through heroic efforts you fix two of those links, the chain's still broken. And it's really an important metaphor because it helps explain how we could spend so much money on salmon recovery efforts and get so little out of it.
So urban areas are still on the hook, but there are other lower-tech ways of improving urban environments. How about native plants? That's what Portland's mayor Sam Adams wants to put along the city's stretch of the Willamette River. It's where Matt Prue runs the CertainTeed Roofing Products plant. Forklifts zip back and forth across the asphalt yard. At the back of his property, a steep path of loose rock leads down to the river. He shows me some trees he planted, just like Portland's mayor wants. Prue likes the idea that fish can be attracted to dense industrial shorelines simply by planting some shrubs. But he worries about giving up too much.
Not even just the large businesses like ourselves, but there's a lot of small businesses that bought property. And I heard from one gentleman saying, you know, I just bought this property with the idea of building my business. And now I'm worried that these restrictions might keep me from doing any business at all.
Prue says he's optimistic that industry and nature can work together, even downtown. It's just a question of cost. I'm Joshua McNichols reporting.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The Fairbanks Rescue Mission is opening a recycling center. The faith-based nonprofit, which provides housing, food, job training, and other services for the homeless, will collect paper, cardboard, and aluminum every Saturday. Rescue Mission Director Rodney Gaskins says the new recycling center will be user-friendly.
The people are going to come through. We're going to have volunteers to help them to get their material out of their car and to sort it so that they can just get back in their car and drive on.
Gaskins says recyclables will be baled with equipment purchased with a $35,000 grant from Walmart. The aluminum cans are going to a local pipe company and the newspaper to an Anchorage outfit that makes cellulose insulation, while the cardboard will be sent out of state for recycling. Shipping is being provided by numerous transportation companies that have empty trucks heading south. Gaskins says recycling is only one benefit of the program.
We're looking at it as a green-collar job for the homeless. Because I realize that a lot of people that come to the rescue mission, they don't have a problem finding a job. They have a problem keeping a job. So I wanted to create a controlled environment where they can work inside the rescue mission and that we can help them to overcome some of their issues to sustained employment.
The Rescue Mission is partnering on the project with Alaska Interfaith Power and Light, a nonprofit group that supports environmental programs. Coordinator Mary Walker says the Rescue Mission's work dovetails well with hers.
Taking people that a lot of others consider to be trash, and I did a lot of work on recycling resources that a lot of people throw in the trash, and so we just joined forces and decided that we wanted to bring a recycling center to the Fairbanks community, but also to provide job training, viable job training for the residents of the mission.
Walker says she's also designed green job programs for Beans Cafe and the Downtown Soup Kitchen in Anchorage and plans to incorporate the new recycling center into an environmental curriculum for local school kids. The bacterial disease meningitis used to be a lot worse in the Waikei Delta among babies. Haemophilus influenza type B, or what's called HIB, caused a lot of the meningitis among infants at a rate that was 6 times higher than the rest of the country. But over the last 25 years, vaccinations have dramatically curbed the disease. KYUK's Alice Criswell has this report.
The state's highest rates of HIB meningitis occurred in children from the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta and the town of Kotzebue, where 2 to 4% of infants got it in the first year of life. Dr. Rosalind Singleton is a medical epidemiologist with the Alaska Division of Public Health.
HIB meningitis was very common in the Waikei Delta, and most families knew of a family member who'd had meningitis.
Singleton says babies who get bacterial meningitis need to be hospitalized and put on antibiotics with an IV. They usually have to be treated from 1 to 3 weeks.
3 bacterial infections cause meningitis, and among those, HIB and strep pneumo are very common in Waikei Delta. And those 2 bacterial infections are spread and carried in the nose and mouth in normal people. And we've found that conditions like living in a house with many people and not having running water are conditions that increase the spread of these 2 bacteria.
Dr. Beth Funk, another medical epidemiologist with the state, says HIB bacteria could get into the spinal fluid around the brain and cause fatal meningitis. The children who survived the disease had a lifetime of major problems. The 3 most common problems are brain damage, cerebral palsy, and deafness. But in 1991, things changed. The HIB vaccine was approved in Alaska. Funk says the HIB disease rates in Alaska children decreased by more than 95%.
Not only is the vaccine effective, but working with the state and the health corporations and the public health nurses and all of the healthcare providers, the children in the Waikei region are very well immunized. Another way to say that is that the rates of immunization are high in the Waikei region. And so this vaccine has been actually getting to the children that need it.
Even though rates of HIB diseases have decreased over the last 25 years, rates in the Waikei Delta are still a lot higher than other parts of the state. Over the last 7 years, 75% of HIB cases in children younger than 10 occurred in the Waikei Delta. That was 11 of 14 cases statewide. Healthcare providers encourage parents to keep babies up to date on immunizations because that is the best way to prevent meningitis. In Bethel, I'm Alice Criswell.
2 eagles that were treated at the Juneau Raptor Center returned to the wild last week. About 100 people showed up at the parking lot next to Brotherhood Bridge to watch them go. Ann Sutton was there and put together this audio postcard.
There's fish in now, so that's always a good time of year. We like to release them when there's food. We start releasing when we can, as soon as the eulachans start to show up in the spring, and we'll release up through about the first snowfall. And then we take some birds to Haines because they have a winter run of salmon up there, and that's in November, so they're pretty good food up there at that time of year.
If we could have your attention, please, we won't make this long, but we're the Juneau Raptor Center, and I know some of you are members. Thank you all for coming. This is an awesome turnout. What we're going to be doing is opening the kennels. Hopefully the bird will go flying right out. If you're down below, we need you to kind of fan out this way so that the bird doesn't see you.
They see a lot of people there. That frightens them because they're not used to looking at people. They're used to looking down. But once they turn around and figure out that they can come out, they can do it. And some of them just explode. You open the door and they're just halfway out before the door's off.
Okay. The first bird we're going to release tonight is an adult female. She came to us about 2 months ago. She was found on the Montana Creek Trail, which is right next to the Juneau Youth Services facility on Back Loop Road. And She was just standing on the trail, right?
Yeah.
And sitting in the trail, and we thought, well, that's really unusual, but we were thinking there was fish in the river. Maybe she was just full or guarding a catch. So we went down and went fishing for a couple hours, and then when we came back, she was actually laying on her breast on the trail, and then we knew something was wrong. So went and called the Raptor Center, and actually we only live like a block away from Kathy.
So I ran over, and she was just standing right there in the middle of the trail when I got there. Easily picked her up. At first they thought she might have some kind of a lung infection, but they did a blood test and they found out that she actually had lead poisoning. It wasn't real bad, but it's enough to make her...
paralyzed?
No, she wasn't paralyzed, but she just was weak, very weak. So we gave her some medicine for that and put her in our flight enclosure, and she is just raring to go. So we'll actually do that release first.
She's just going to drop the door down?
You're just going to take it away.
Okay.
All right. Okay, you ready?
Sure.
Everybody ready with your cameras?
Yeah.
Okay. One, two, three.
Come on, Montana. Come on, girl.
Montana.
Girl.
Look, you're free.
Go. Right. Yeah.
She's like, oh, I don't know. This bird was found approximately a year ago from South Shelter Island. It's a juvenile. It was a first year when it came into the Raptor Center. It was very thin, so basically the bird probably wasn't getting enough nutrition in the nest. They leave the nest, and they kind of have catch-up to do, and they have a hard time doing it. And so we've had this bird. It broke its tail while it was in the flight enclosure because of a weakness in the tail feathers. So we had to wait for the tail to molt out. But this bird is very ready to go, and she's just beating up all the other eagles. So that's why her name is Bully. So I'm sure they're glad to see her go, too.
The juveniles actually look bigger than the adults, and they actually are. Their feathers are longer, which makes flying easier to begin with. And then as they mold out to the white head and white tail, their feathers mold in shorter and shorter until they have their adult size feather. A lot of adaptation there to prevent that first flight from being too traumatic.
Okay, you ready? All right, here we go. One, two, three. Come on, Bully. Oh, you're just standing there. Hey, don't you want to go free? Get going. There you go. Yay! That's it. Thank you.
The voices belong to Scott Tiernan, Pat Bach, and Kathy Benner of the Raptor Center, and Michelle Klawan. Each raptor is released with an ID bracelet on its leg. Information about the bird is entered into a central database at the Patuxent Bird Banding Laboratory in Maryland. If you find a dead bird with a band on its leg, let the Raptor Center know so it can be identified. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Adam Kane in Dillingham, Ben Stanton in Kenai, Joshua McNichols in Seattle, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alice Criswell in Bethel, and Ann Sutton in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business with data transfer speeds up to Gig E. ACS, connecting Alaska companies to each other and the rest of the world.
And by the Alaska Engineering Fund, whose members include USKH Incorporated, a multidiscipline design firm offering architecture, engineering, planning, and environmental services. Information online at uskh.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.